ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. Talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
One of the things that we have created over the last 20 years is systems and processes for people to actually think about this stuff differently. And again, like anyone, making it tangible and practical. So again, theoretically, yeah, okay, sure, Aboriginal people want to have a say in their lives. Okay, but how? How do we make that real? How do we make it tangible? And how does that fit into what I know and understand? And do I have the confidence that we've got the right things in place to make it work?
Reconciliation, constitutional recognition, and where to from here. In conversation with Karen Mundine. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Where to for reconciliation in the wake of the Voice to Parliament referendum last October? What does a decisive no vote mean for Australia? These are the questions many are asking. Karen Mundine is a Bundjalung woman from the New South Wales North Coast. She's been on the front line of efforts to create better awareness of First Nations issues for almost three decades. As CEO of Reconciliation Australia, she has extensive experience in community engagement and public advocacy. She's played an important role in some of Australia's most significant national events, including the National Apology to the Stolen Generations, Corroboree 2000, and a couple of Australian Reconciliation Conventions, just to name a few. I sat down with Karen to reflect on the current landscape for First Nations people and find out more about her remarkable story. Now, before we get into the many things you've done with your life, I'd love to talk about where it all started. So can you tell us where you grew up, but importantly, who and what shaped your values and your worldview?
Yeah, so I grew up in Western Sydney, so Auburn, and I was actually raised by my grandparents. So mum had me 70s out of wedlock. She wanted to make life better for herself and for me in the process, and so she was working, which meant that, my grandparents essentially raised me along with a tribe of aunties and uncles and cousins. But very much my grandmother, I guess, was that matriarch in my life, and certainly today I still hear her voice in the back of my mind and certainly in my ear, mostly sort of having a crack at me about, you know, what are you doing, or you're not listening, or those kind of things. But I guess both of my grandparents and my entire family, I guess we had that social justice, Indigenous rights. My grandmother was quite staunchly Catholic, and so that kind of social justice kind of bent came through. And I also remember there was this idea that, you know, compared to some others, we got a lot of privilege. So my grandparents made a choice to move away from country to come down to Sydney to provide opportunities, mostly education and employment for their kids. And then kind of the next generation, that expectation that we go to school, we do well. But all of that was about how do we make things better for us? Because if we make things better for us, how do we then give that back to mob and community? So even though we grew up off country, we were constantly going back. We knew our mob, we knew our country, we knew our family. And that was really important to, I guess, grounding us on both sides of the family, so both Donovan's and Mundine.
And so what drew you to wanting to work in Indigenous affairs? Was it kind of expected because you had such an active family in the space, or was there something very personal from your own experience or your own belief system?
Yeah, look, I think, it kind of was inherent in the family, so you couldn't really escape it. But I don't know that there was particularly an expectation. The expectation was that you did well whatever you did. And I guess my background from a work point of view was comms and marketing. And I was kind of fascinated by how do you get people to do things? How do you put together an argument? How do you influence people, whether it's through debating or for your policy, whatever that might be? And what I came to know early in my career, I was almost kind of determined not to do Indigenous affairs, sort of having grown up around it. It was like, no, I want to make my mark in the other world.
You're being rebellious.
Maybe. But I guess the more I did it, the more, I guess the better I became at it, what I realised was it's really important to the work or to seeing better outcomes for mob and for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And I guess somewhere in my 20s and 30s realised, actually, you're good at this and you could actually make a difference back with our mob. And I guess in some respects that's kind of how and why I've landed in this reconciliation space, because it's having worked in that non-Indigenous world, knowing how that works and knowing how to influence that, how do I use those kind of negatives, or not negative, but how do I use those powers for good?
I first really saw you in action, I think, it was many years ago now. We were very young, but one of those very powerful first impressions of somebody, and it was with the work that you did around the Corroboree 2000, which of course was a really important moment in time for those of us who remember it. Mm-hmm. You know, the handing over of the documents of reconciliation, the culmination of a really long reconciliation process, and of course the bridge walk. Mm-hmm. So tell me about what it was like at that time for you to be so central to such an important moment and the sorts of things that you were doing at that time.
So by that stage, I had worked with the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, but actually by that time coming into the lead into 2000s, I'd moved into mainstream public service area and I was actually working on the Centenary of Federation commemorations. But I guess because of the connection, because of the work, and because both in the Centenary of Federation, as we think about the birth, and I do air quotes there, the birth of the modern Australian nation, like what is the place of Indigenous people in that story as well? So it was really important to kind of bridge those connections between Corroboree 2000s, as well as you say, it was such a momentous thing to not be part of it after working in that space for so long. It kind of was a blur, to be really honest. There were so many things going on and so many people being involved. It was that culmination of the work of the council, so the 10 years leading up to that, it was the what's next. In the external environment, you had a Howard government who was refusing to acknowledge stolen generations, refusing to apologise, and we were in the kind of shadow of an Olympics and international stage kind of looking at us as Australians. So that entire year was such a whirlwind. It was also really nice. My previous boss at the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, Brian Ahrens, he had this vision of this idea of people walking across the Sydney Harbour Bridge and coming together in this show of reconciliation. And it was one of those things, again, as a young staffer, we would kind of roll our eyes a little bit. But he made it happen. And to be part of that and to be involved in it, again, so, you know, those moments in life that you look back, I will forever remember that. I will forever remember walking across the bridge with my family, so my grandfather, my mother, uncles and aunts, cousins, and just to see that outpouring of people and not the usual suspects, you know, not the usual people that go to an Aboriginal event or to a Yarban or a survival concert. It was non-Indigenous young families. It was multicultural families who are walking across the bridge. And to this day, I still meet people who say, yeah, I was there. And I've got staff who now work with me who were there as kids crossing with their families. So to be part of something that was just so huge in our nation, I feel very, very special.
I'm going to ask you about another hugely important historic moment that you were involved in a minute. But before I do, I just want to pull something out of what you've said, because I think it's really important in terms of what you've been able to achieve in your current role. And you do talk about the fact that you've worked in the mainstream, but also that you'll put yourself in a position where you're sort of, you know, Centenary of Federation, that's a tricky space for an Aboriginal person, a First Nations person to be in. But you do, I think you've always sort of risen to the challenge of being able to navigate those spaces quietly, with a lot of determination.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm that quiet, but look, I mean, the Centenary of Federation stuff, it was partly a chance again to work on something that was big and momentous. And, you know, I was a nerd, you know, our family was a very sporting mad family, as the surname might suggest, but I was the kid in the corner reading a book, the kid in the corner, you know, learning history, that kind of stuff. So history, and I guess political history, has always kind of interested me. And so this idea of celebrating 100 years of this dominant culture was intriguing to me. And I got to work with some amazing people. And at that point, again, I wanted to work with the best, not because they were the best Aboriginal people and I didn't want to be the best Aboriginal person in this job. I just wanted to be good at it, no matter what. So that opportunity was definitely an attraction. And then the kind of secondary part to that was, well, we've been here this entire time. So we're part of this story too. So if there's a way for me to influence that, to have a say, or to even just, you know, put your hand up and say, hang on a minute, we were here. We were part of those celebrations. We were part of that conversation. And in fact, we were excluded in a lot of those conversations. That's really important. So again, it's a challenge and I like a challenge.
You're quite right. Quiet was not the right word to use. I think it's more, I would think of it as what might be termed soft diplomacy, but certainly not quiet. Of course, the other thing that you were involved in was the apology to the Stolen Generations. And I wonder if you can share with us your reflections on what that day meant to you and how you feel when you look back, because it's become so iconic.
It is absolutely the highlight of my career. I don't think there's anything I could ever do to top it. It was such an honour to work with Stolen Generations. So my role there was to help Stolen Generations tell their story and explain that to the rest of Australia in a way that wasn't going to trigger or harm them, but in a way that would help the rest of Australia understand what had happened, but more importantly, why this was so important and so why saying sorry meant something. And spending that time with them, sitting down, helping them reconstruct those stories to reduce their harm was such an honour. And I don't think I can ever do anything that will ever top that. Again, on the day, it was such a blur. It was such a big day. But I have a very vivid memory of being in the gallery inside the chamber. I think some of the people that I was looking after, because I had to get them to media interviews sort of directly after, were either on the floor in the chamber or in one of the other galleries. And I just remember sitting there by myself and looking around and seeing a whole bunch of people that I knew, both family, friends, and I found myself quite emotional. In a way that I was sort of, I guess I'd been pushing aside because you just got to get the job done. But that kind of sense of relief and that sense of, are we actually turning a corner here in terms of our relationship with the broader Australia, with the government and with the state?
It is a surprisingly emotional time still. I mean, I often have to go and look at footage of it when I'm making a film. And it's not even what's in the gallery, but when you look at the faces in the crowd, yeah, and the particularly the old men, there's just particular things. How do you feel now when you look back on it?
When I see footage, it chokes me up every time, and particularly when I look at footage of people who are no longer with us, and it makes me think of the people that weren't around to hear that apology, to be part of that. You know, every Aboriginal person has been touched or affected by Stolen Generations, whether your family members were stolen or not. And my family were not, luckily. But again, we grew up with stories of kids being told to scatter as soon as anyone from sort of government came around. So, and kids would scoop up younger kids and go hide in the creek or, you know, get out of town or get out of sight. And that has an effect, and it's a generational effect, like I said, whether or not you were stolen or not. So, again, to be part of something that helped uncover that and expose that and contribute to some kind of level of understanding from the major or the broader community was really special.
There's always a lot of rhetoric around reconciliation, and a lot of First Nations people can feel like things like commitments to reconciliation, action plans, etc., or reconciliation statements are tokenistic. So I think one of the really important things that you've done with your work is to establish the Australian Reconciliation Barometer, because it helped give shape and understanding to where we were and became a very meaningful tool. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the process of developing that and what it has shown and achieved.
Yeah, so we pinched the idea from South Africa and the barometer that they were conducting at the time. But I guess making it relevant in an Australian context. And really what we were trying to do was come up with a communication strategy. And so rule one of your comm strategy is to get some evidence. And there was no real evidence base. So lots of surveys and lots of academic research done on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but nothing that really gave us a sense of, well, what are our opinions on these kind of issues? And then also, what does the broader community think about these issues? And for me, that's the gaps that we're trying to bridge here. So trying to understand, what do people think about each other? If we take the politics out of this, what do we truly believe? Where are the opportunities where we actually believe the same things? And, you know, when it comes down to personalities of what it means to be Australian, very similar things when it comes down to things like what's important to you. You know, it's family, it's about safety, it's about having opportunities. So rather than talking about where are we starting on opposite scales, where are the areas where we actually believe and think the same things? And how do we build on that to start a relationship or restart a relationship?
Reconciliation Australia was set up to carry on the work of the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation. So it's had quite a long lifetime now, and you've been involved with it in various ways, but you now lead that organisation. I wonder, just from your perspective, what have you seen as the key role of the organisation, and how has that changed over time from where we were the end of 2000 to where we are now?
I think, in its simplest form, our job is, how do we engage the majority of Australians into this idea of reconciliation? What's happened over the last 20 years is a refining of what does that mean and a teasing out of what that definition is. And again, running parallel, I guess, to the rights movement that's happening for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, how do we ensure that that is what's driving what this kind of reconciled Australia looks like, and not just a cover-up or a whitewashing of what the majority state wants it to look like, which, you know, I hear the criticisms, and there are times when I get frustrated as well, because people can fall into the, oh, well, we'll just do this and that makes it okay. And, you know, we've got Aboriginal languages now, so everything's good. And it's like, yeah, look, all of that's part of it, but it's not the end of it. So I guess, if anything, what we've tried to do is get pointier and sharper. And as we've built this coalition of allies and people who believe in reconciliation, and particularly at the moment, it has to be pointier now, and it has to talk about rights in a real and tangible way. And it can't just be about morning teas and, you know, people feeling good about themselves. It's part of it. Like, we all need to and want to feel that we're getting somewhere and feel that we're making progress, but it can't stop at the morning teas. It's got to keep pushing through.
Obviously, the referendum last year raised a lot of issues around how we talk about First Nations people and how we're spoken about. And I hear a lot of people now say they feel, as a First Nations person, that when they're in a room, that 60% that voted against us is how they frame it, how people frame it, makes them feel like that we've still got a long way to go. And I wonder, from your perspective, what you think the lessons are from the referendum. What do we need to do going forward?
Yeah, look, there are moments when I do look around. I walk outside to the shops and I think about, yeah, you voted yes, no, you voted no, definitely.
Isn't it funny how we all do, I do that too, and be on the bus or...
Yeah.
I've never done that before.
No. And I think, because of the nature of a referendum, you know, it's such a binary yes or no kind of answer. So it kind of laid bare that. The problem with a yes and no answer is that these things are nuanced and they are complicated. They're both simple and complicated, both at the same time. And they're layered as well. So on any one question, of course, you can say yes or no, but there are all sorts of reasons that sit behind that. And it's not as simple as, I voted no because I'm a racist or I don't believe this. It's a lot more nuanced than that. What I think it's shown, certainly what it's shown us or confirmed for us, probably more to the point, is we still have a long way to go. But we don't want to dismiss that we actually have made progress. So there were 62 million Australians who did say yes. There were 60,000 people who volunteered their time on weekends to hand out flyers, to door knock, to make phone calls. Is it where we wanted to be or needed to be? No. But it's certainly a lot longer or a lot further along in this journey than it was 20 years ago. And I would argue that we have better skills and better, I know how to make a difference. So one of the things that we have created over the last 20 years is systems and processes for people to actually think about this stuff differently. And again, like anyone, making it tangible and practical. So again, theoretically, yeah, okay, sure, Aboriginal people want to have a say in their lives. Okay, but how? How do we make that real? How do we make it tangible? And how does that fit into what I know and understand, and do I have the confidence that we've got the right things in place to make it work?
It does seem, just in what you've said there, there's real wisdom in remembering how far we've come. It's very easy to think that our relationship with the broader community is defined by the referendum, but you're quite right. I think back to when I was at school, we didn't have NAIDOC, didn't have acknowledgements of country. There was no mention of Indigenous place names. There was no place for Indigenous language. From your perspective, from your lived experience, how would you describe the things that you feel have been progress over the last 25 years?
So just that visibility of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, you know, above and beyond these kind of small pockets of where you would expect to see Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So we have doctors, we have lawyers, we have investment bankers, we have teachers, we have elders that work in schools and preschools that are teaching languages to the broader community. That all helps to tell the story of a particular place. And even the fact that we think about it in those kind of terms, and that there are these younger generations and families that understand that idea of place and connection to community and to a physical geographic area. The fact that we have had the apology and that we are chipping away at this bigger story of an identity of who we are as Australians, and that that is somehow intrinsically linked to who we are as First Nations peoples. There are so many more things that need to happen without doubt. And if anything, the referendum should be a wake-up call to those 62 million who are supporters, and even those who perhaps voted no because they felt that it wasn't the right thing or the right time or whatever the case might be, but still want to see things get better. This is their wake-up call that actually we've got to do more. And that's why that our theme for Reconciliation Week is now more than ever. Like, now more than ever, we need our allies to step up. Now more than ever, it can't be the First Nations person, and I say person, not people, in the room, constantly having to correct or kind of correct the record or sort of suggest that, hey, you know, there should be Indigenous perspectives in here. That's the role of other Australians to step into that, to not say what those perspectives are, but just to say, hang on a minute, we need to get a perspective here that's beyond the kind of status quo. There's always more to do, but I feel like we're getting better at knowing what those pathways are, and we've got better tools and resources and skills to do that.
That's CEO of Reconciliation Australia, Karen Mundine. For the past 25 years, she's been working to achieve better outcomes for First Nations people.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABCRN, Radio Australia, on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. Coming up, more from my conversation with Karen Mundine. Right now, though, some music from Dan Sultan.
Out there in the covering, in the baskings of a holy night. Oh, I was lucid and conscious, and hovering like a firefly. Mind stretched out on the canopy, put its arms out slow. seen days under a southern sun. And there were times when I thought that I wouldn't mind it if I lost my mind. Out there, you wouldn't believe me if I told you so. The things I saw were enough to make a man in me a man in me. Make a man of me. Come on, come on, I'm ready now. Go catch your things up, honey, let's get ready to roll.
That's Dan Sultan with Southern Sun, recorded live on Triple J's Like a Version.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
Karen Mundine is the CEO of Reconciliation Australia. She's been instrumental in a number of landmark national events in Indigenous affairs. In her current role, her focus has been on bridging the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. Last year, it was the Voice to Parliament referendum which threw up a number of difficult conversations as we considered how best to recognise First Nations people in our constitution.
Iwi struck me as such an optimistic person, and I imagine that is a very key thing to have, characteristic to have in the work that you do. As the CEO of Reconciliation Australia, what are your priorities now going forward? Looking forward, what is it that, you know, you really want to achieve now in the role, given what we've just been through in the last year?
So really it's, well, first and foremost, it's always about supporting the team. The team make me look good, and the team do a lot of the hard work and the repetitive conversations again and again. It is about making sure that our allies really understand what's at stake here, because I feel that they've had a tangible disappointment in the referendum. And so it's like, rather than wallowing that or walking away, now is the time to dig in and to push forward. And then, you know, the ideals that were in the Uluru Statement, so voice, treaty, truth, those concepts haven't gone away in terms of being important to First Nations rights. So how do we look at doing that in different ways? And, you know, the RAP program grew out of a refusal from the government to apologise. So how can other organisations, other institutions get involved? How can other people do things? And what does that look like in those local communities? So how do we tell the story of this suburb's name, or why, you know, that particular street or that particular creek might have a, you know, not so great name? Let's unpack that and let's own that. And let's find every single part of our lives being centred around First Nations peoples and values and stories.
One thing you said there that I think is really important to remember is that when you don't get leadership from the government level, whether it's federal or state, there is actually a grassroots community movement that is really where reconciliation was born from.
Yep.
That will do things anyway. And you think of your observation reminded me of the fact that during the Howard era, you had such active local reconciliation groups. For people who are listening, who are very interested in these issues, you obviously offer a really safe, reliable place for people to go to find out more information or get involved. What are some of the ways in which a person listening who wants to learn more or be more active can get involved through Reconciliation Australia?
Well, definitely check out our website, and we've got both lots of resources and information. We've also got lots of links to other organisations that are doing similar works. There's so much great Indigenous media these days. So there is great films, there's great radio programs, television programs. There's lots of different ways to broaden your thinking and then just being engaged in the political structures. And I know that there's kind of this kind of downward trend of people reading newspapers and whatnot, but if we're going to talk about rights, and if we're going to talk about how do we do things differently so we make things better, not just for First Nations people, we know when we get it right in a RAP, for example, not only does it benefit First Nations peoples, it benefits women, people from multicultural heritages, people from different religious backgrounds. It gets all of us to rise up. So it actually creates different ways of thinking, broadening out what the opportunity might be, and then creating things that sometimes we haven't even dreamt of yet. So I would just encourage people to engage. There are now more ways than ever to engage in the issues, learning what country that you live on or that you work on. Find out if your organisation does have a reconciliation action plan, or if your kid's school or preschool has a Narraganawali RAP. There are all sorts of ways to get engaged and involved, and I think that's the biggest call we would ever ask for people, is to get involved, because if we want to live in a democracy that celebrates difference and diversity and honours First Nations peoples, we have to be active citizens. We can't just kind of go, oh, well, that'll sort itself out, or, you know, First Nations peoples will figure it out. We're only 3% of the population. We need everyone to be on our side.
I do just want to underline the fantastic work that's on your website to help schools in this space. And I know just from my own experience, a lot of teachers would love to have more Indigenous content but don't feel confident
Yep.
about teaching the material because they themselves didn't get taught it and don't want to do it badly
Yep.
or cause offence. So I think the investment that you've made into skilling schools and teachers will have a huge impact. So I just wanted to highlight that that's a really important part of what you're doing. I have mentioned how much I've sort of admired and watched your work in this reconciliation space, but this January I got to see you up close on lots of occasions because, of course, in Sydney, it's Sydney Festival time. My husband and I love going to the shows as often as we can, almost every night, sometimes twice a night. And I ran into you all the time because, of course, you're now on the board. And I wondered if you could tell us how you got involved with Sydney Festival and why you love it so much.
So I have been a fan of the Sydney Festival for a very, very long time. As a child, I remember going to see a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream in Hyde Park. So it was all outdoors. It was all fairy lights. There were people dressed up as donkeys. It captured my imagination and it certainly lit a light under me in terms of love for theatre and arts and that creative spaces. As an adult, or certainly as a young adult, I became sort of, I would start to go to shows. And it's just a great time. Like in January, it's a great way to spend your summer evenings to see theatre. And I guess just over the years, I've gone to more and more shows. And I guess the team at Sydney Festival, like you, would run into me quite a lot. And so I suspect, well, in fact, I know that was part of the reason that they asked me to join the board. But it's such a great organisation to be part of. I am not artistic in that kind of respects, but I bring these other skills around thinking about governance and how do we do structure and how do we support creatives to do that amazing work. Yeah, I've been loving my time on the board. I'm still a newbie, but it's been awesome. And then, you know, the great work that Jake Nash does as well in terms of that Indigenous program kicked off with Wesley Enoch, but also the focus now of the festival, you know, as the first of the state or the big festivals in Australia to kick off, having, and particularly Sydney, you know, the history of this place and colonisation and those early contact years is so important to be threaded through. How do we reimagine that both for the now but to the future?
It's been lovely to see that evolution where First Nations work is now really central. And I think one of the things that's really wonderful about the festival is it is a place that's experimental. It will invest in early iterations of works. Michael and I always say it's not a great festival unless we go to something we really hate because we just haven't tried enough experimental stuff, but it is quite joyous. But surely you must see a lot of synergy between the importance of performance and art and storytelling and your work in Reconciliation Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see those things tying together?
Oh, absolutely, because at the end of the day, reconciliation is about telling stories, stories of place and stories of people. And we're also looking for new ways of thinking and new ways of attaching or addressing old problems and old issues. And so culture and art is such an intrinsic part of the human experience. And it is so intrinsic to who we are as First Nations peoples. And so if we can connect the broader audience with these stories, if they can see something of their human condition in an Indigenous artwork, but it speaks to them as a parent or as someone who cares about the environment or, you know, who challenges sort of political thinking. It's a great way to have that conversation or start that conversation that isn't threatening, that isn't, you know, a hard policy or a boring lecture, but actually just captures people's imaginations in different ways. And I think arts are so vital and important to challenging us, to, you know, just tweaking things so you see things that little bit differently that might spark the imagination of something else.
And it has, I guess, been, there's kind of a renaissance now. You mentioned Jake Nash, who came out of Bangarra. They've been a seed for, a number of really important creatives. But I think back to 10 years ago, we didn't have the volume of writing. We didn't have the volume of performance. From your perspective and experience, how important is it that we continue to ensure that this ecosystem's really vibrant? And what's the way in which non-Indigenous people should be supporting that?
The easiest way that non-Indigenous people can support is to go out and see shows, to see films, to buy books, to support theatre companies and dance companies. It's to create that market for these things to thrive. It is such a great and so nice to see new artists coming into these creative forms. But again, this goes back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. These are connections to who we are as people and as First Nations peoples. And it's just taking these modern forms. And you know, there's some amazing digital and like virtual art and things that are happening in forms that were never, ever considered. But again, telling stories, old stories in new ways. And I think that's got to be exciting. Like the fact that there are First Nations and Aboriginal comic book heroes and that are, you know, again, it's how do we reach as many people in different forms, in different ways that just sparks recognition and connection.
You're so right. People can find something for everybody.
Absolutely.
Now in the diversity of what's coming out of our First Nations creatives. Now, I've known you for a very long time and I know what a humble person you are. You are very much a behind-the-scenes person with your role with media and communications, particularly before you took on the role as CEO of Reconciliation Australia. But even then, you know, I think your voice struck me as somebody who's incredibly interested in the outcomes and not so much of a self-promoter. You're very good at promoting other people.
Absolutely.
So I was very pleased to see that you were awarded an alumni award from UTS in 2021. And I also want to acknowledge that in 2023, you were the national winner of the Australian Awards for Excellence in Women's Leadership. I would assume they were neither awards that you put yourself forward for, but other people did. But for someone who's been so comfortable behind the scenes, how did it feel that other people felt that you needed to be acknowledged?
Look, I shunned the spotlight, that's for sure. So there's that level of discomfort in being suddenly pushed into that spotlight. It's always nice to be recognised, to know that somebody else sees what you're trying to do. But for me, it was more about how to use that platform to highlight not just my work, but the work of our organisation, for my team, and for the hundreds and thousands of people who are out there every day doing hard slog. I get to have the conversations and be in the kind of rooms that I'm in because of the work of so many others that came before me and so many more that are at the coalface, for want of a better term. And so to be able to speak to that, to use that platform and that spotlight to shine the light or reflect the light back onto them, that's what makes me feel more comfortable with the idea that I'm out the front.
Yes, I have to say you never feel like that's exactly where you want to be is in the spotlight. But from your personal perspective, with everything that you've achieved, all the things you've been involved in that we've covered, when you look back, what is the thing that you're most proud of or that means the most to you? They're usually not the things that someone gets awards for, but when you look back, what's the thing that, you know, in your heart has really felt like that's been something that you'll carry with you?
As I said, there's been those big moments that I will always look back as the kind of absolute highlights. And as I said, working with those stolen generations and to be the keeper of their story. So not that I worked on that big campaign, but that they trusted me to help them shape and tell their story for this bigger and greater good. And I think that would be the thing when I'm old and dottery sitting in my rocking chair is the thing that I'll be most proud of. If I can draw those links of where I'm just the custodian of the process or the story or the doing, but that it had this impact across the widest and greatest group of people possible. And I think that's the thing that I will be most proud of.
Well, you've still got plenty more to achieve between now and Dottery on the in the Blackfella old folks home. One of the things that I've always been struck by in the way that your leadership style is that you're very inclusive and you've been also very good at acknowledging and supporting your peers and building that peer group around you and offering support in that way. So I was wondering, how do you look after yourself? How do you keep yourself strong, especially given, you know, you're incredibly optimistic, you've spoken about all the great things that are there and you're doing, but, you know, some of it's really hard.
Yeah. Well, that peer group and that kind of, you know, the chosen family that I have, as well as my actual family, are always there for me, which is, you know, again, that knowing that they have my back, knowing that they will always be there and that if necessary, you know, they will make me food when I don't have time to eat because I've been travelling or take me off for a cocktail because something's just making my head explode and I need to not be around it. So those people that are close to me and are absolutely my support mechanisms in all of this, and they allow me to do the things that I do. And even my family giving me passes when I'm absent in family, at family events, or I haven't gone back to country as often as I should, but they give me that leave pass because they know that what I do has a big impact and is important. So that's really helpful. And then, you know, doing things like Sydney Festival and the arts and immersing myself in these other worlds. I love to read. I love to travel, and being able to travel the world and not be Karen Mundine, CEO of Reconciliation Australia, but just some tourist or somebody who appreciates food and beauty and hearing the history of other places and stories and finding connection there. So I think I'm pretty good at sort of putting limits around myself too. So I will go hard, but when I need to step out, and there will be times that are, as the team knows, sort of I'm out and I turn the phone off and the phone goes into a drawer and I am uncontactable for the next week or so. So it's finding those things.
Just thinking, that sounds like bliss.
But I mean, you have to be disciplined about that yourself. It's really easy to not do those things. It's really easy to, there's always something going on. There's always something to be engaged in. And so after last year, this year is my year of saying no more often. It hasn't worked so far, but we'll continue to try.
That's right. Just keep practicing.
But yeah, it's just trying to find things outside that nourish me and refill the cup.
You're so right. There's a thing that's very powerful for an Aboriginal person in Australia to go overseas and leave the politics,
yep,
and the labelling behind you. I totally get that. My final question is, I know you probably don't see yourself this way, but you are such a role model for younger First Nations women, CEO of a national organisation, doing important work at the coalface. But it's also, I think, an increasingly difficult environment for First Nations women to lead in, for no other reason for the toxicity of social media and the ability for racism to, mm-hmm, to come at you so much more easily than it used to. So I wonder what your advice is for younger First Nations people who are interested and aspire to be the kind of change maker that you are, but might feel that there are things that might be intimidating or unsafe about that.
I guess I'm lucky in that I grew up sort of and came into this pre kind of the social media world. So I'm not as embedded. But again, to that point of being able to turn my phone off and put it in a drawer, I think you do have to find those boundaries for yourself. And for me, that's, you know, I find that I don't engage in social media as much as I used to when I was younger and certainly before I was in this role. You've always got to have a bit of a thick skin, but with that thick skin comes knowing that you're doing the work and believing in the work that you're doing. And then to help you and to protect you, I guess, is having those good people around you. So whether it's family, whether it's urban family, the people that will give you good advice, who will help you look after yourself if you're not looking after yourself. And I mean that not just in a physical sense, but a mental and social sense as well. And then I think part of that is also the people who will ground you and kind of, you know, my grandmother's voice in the back of my head that kind of slapping me around the back of the head, that kind of go, remember why you do this and remember what is important. And so I think in anything, it's being, standing behind your work and having good people around you.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for your body of work that we've discussed, the inspiring energy that you bring with you, and in a year where you're learning to say no, you didn't say no to me and coming on the show.
How can I say no to you?
Thank you. That's CEO of Reconciliation Australia, Karen Mundine. Karen has dedicated her career to advancing unity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. To take us out, we'll leave you with some music from Thelma Plum. This is Homecoming Queen.
Saw anyone quite like me. was hard for me. I would never speak up out of turn about those blonde blue-eyed girls. They were beautiful, but it was hard, hard for me to dream. Be the boss of this town. You'll be your own homecoming queen. Forget all the shit that you've seen. Put on the crown. When I was a teenager, awkward body hair and big hairy head, it was harder, so much harder than it seemed. I am a woman now. I feel beautiful and I love myself. But it was hard to get used to me. I'll be my own homecoming queen. As long as it feels good to me, I'll be the boss of this town. You'll be your own homecoming queen. Forget all the shit that you've seen. Put on that crown. 'Cause in 1967 I wasn't human. And in 1994
the show for now. Join us again next time for more inspiring stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Jay McAllister and Sarah Allerley. You can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt.
Been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.